Professor of European History at Notre Dame, Brad Gregory, argues that the Reformation changed the world, but not in the ways Luther and Calvin expected, nor would have approved.
The view of religion that virtually everyone is inculcated with in the United States today, for example, right? Religion is a matter of individual preference about your own beliefs, your interior beliefs, about your preferred forms of worship in whatever religious community or church you want to belong to, and of your own individually chosen devotional practices, Bible study. If you're a Catholic, you might say the rosary, whatever the case may be. But religion certainly isn't about the public exercise of political power or about the regulation of economic exchange, right? Those are separate from religion. That difference is at the heart of what was wrought by the conflicts of the Reformation era.
Brad Gregory is the author of Rebel in the Ranks, Martin Luther, the Reformation, and the conflicts that continue to shape our world. It is time for Progressive Spirit. Stay with us. Progressive Spirit is produced every week. It couldn't happen without the financial support of my congregation, Southminster Presbyterian Church in Beaverton, Oregon. Southminster's website is www.southmin.org. Progressive Spirit is produced in the studios of KBOO in Portland, Oregon, for the Pacifica Radio Network and PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, as well as podcast. Show KBOO some love, won't you? KBOO.fm and click donate. For the Pacifica Radio Network, the Public Radio Exchange, Global Community Radio, and from the studios of KBOO in Portland, Oregon, this is Progressive Spirit, progressivespirit.net. I'm John Schuck.
What happened is in the 17th and the 18th centuries, we see a very explicit and deliberate transformation of the valence and the assessment of what had been regarded as the deadly sin of avarice in Christianity, and it flips. A better way maybe to think about this is every time you see self-interest in the modern world, think of avarice. Basically, it's just called something less offensive. But the idea, the assumption that people naturally want more and better stuff, that there's nothing wrong with this, that in fact this is a benign and a wonderful way in which, right, the market serves human desires and so forth, this is, it's absolutely pervasive. From a traditional Christian point of view, there is absolutely no doubt whatsoever that what is regarded today as perfectly normal, natural, people going, acquiring more things, discarding things, getting more things and so forth, for more than 1500 years in Christianity was regarded as a deadly sin and destructive not only of individual souls, but also of the common good and of individuals' relationship with God.
Martin Luther may very well turn over in his grave if he was able to see what happened to what he started 500 years ago, the Reformation. Studying its effects is not just for religious people. According to Notre Dame professor of European history, Brad Gregory, the very way we conceive of private and public spheres today was an ironic result of the effects of the Reformation era and its wars. Professor Brad Gregory has won numerous awards for his books. He's the author of Salvation at Stake, Christian Martyrdom in Early Modern Europe, and The Unintended Reformation, How a Religious Revolution Secularized Society. In 2017, for the 500th anniversary of the Reformation, he published Rebel in the Ranks, Martin Luther, the Reformation, and the Conflicts That Continue to Shape Our World. It's now in paperback. Dr. Gregory is with me via Skype from South Bend, Indiana. Welcome to Progressive Spirit.
Thank you very much. It's great to be on the show.
Many books have been written about Martin Luther and the Reformation. I had to read a number of them when I was in seminary. And yours, if you ask me the titles, I will have forgotten by now. But yours was published in 2017 on the 500th anniversary of what is considered the birth of the Reformation. Well, what's the focus of your book?
Right. Well, thanks. My book is, although Martin Luther appears on the cover, and he is almost exclusively the subject of the first of the book's four chapters, the book really has the intention and the scope of starting with Luther and the context of his world, and then moving from him as an individual through the early German Reformation of the 1520s and early 1530s, From there, expanding to consider the whole Reformation era in the 16th and 17th centuries in Europe, and then finally concluding with some analysis that leads to a consideration of the ways in which the modern world, as we know it, both in North America, in Western Europe, and in influential ways in many other parts of the world too, is in many important respects the long-term unintended consequence of the Reformation era. So the book starts with Martin Luther. It starts with an individual, and it expands both in its chronological compass and in its geographical frames as well as it moves closer to the present.
You know, we count the date of the Reformation, October 31st, 1517, when Luther posted his 95 Theses on the Wittenberg door. It's an iconic image, an act of defiance, and Protestants who regard Luther as a hero seem to regard it that way. But was it even an act of defiance? Did it even happen?
Well, that's a good question, one that got a fair amount of press last year in 2017, in the quincentenary year of the traditional beginning of the Protestant Reformation. Well, Luther posted the 95 Theses in the sense of sent them through the post, but that's not the usual meaning of the way in which he is thought to have posted them. He sent them to the Archbishop of Mainz, Albrecht, and that was the really important thing that he did with the 95 Theses. The idea and the image that he tacked them up or posted them actually on the door in Wittenberg is almost surely the creation of later a later iconography. It's primarily a 19th century image. Luther himself never referred to any such act, and given the extent to which he was reflective about his own past, once he became the most important first generation leader of the Reformation, one would have thought that he would have referred to it. There isn't any mention of anything like that until after Luther's death. So it's almost certain that it didn't happen in the way that it's been understood and depicted.
And the significance of that, as I was thinking about it, is kind of the myth-making around that he's defying the authorities, really. It kind of serves a sectarian religious interest, because for him, himself, he wasn't about that at all, was he?
No, not at all. And that's one of the things that certainly came out in a lot of the scholarship that was done this past year. There was an enormous outpouring of scholarship on Luther for 2017. And the best of that scholarship for sure reaffirmed the extent to which in late 1517, Luther is a devout Augustinian friar concerned, like many other conscientious clergy were, with problems within the church, and had been for generations before that. It's not really until we get well into 1519, and certainly by the middle of 1520, that Luther has taken a much more hostile and critical, defiant turn. So by then, we can certainly speak of Luther having turned a corner. But a defiance at the very outset of when the 95 Theses are written? No, not at all.
Luther challenged the authority of popes and the councils, the sola scriptura, you know, the phrase, only the Bible. But he didn't think that the Bible would require someone to interpret it.
Oh, he definitely thought that it would require someone to interpret it, if by someone to interpret it you mean Martin Luther. What he disagreed with was anybody who didn't agree with his interpretation of it. So whether one regards that as sort of Luther not thinking that Scripture really needed to be interpreted, or whether he thought it needed to be interpreted properly, i.e. by him, functionally, that's really essentially the same thing. By the time he comes back from the better part of a year hiding out in later part of 1521 up until Lent of 1522, he comes back. In a series of sermons in March of 1522, that's when he articulates a kind of a sort of personal authority over against those in his adoptive city, his new hometown, as it were, of Wittenberg, against those who are wanting to take the Reformation in a different direction and disagree with him. He says then, "I was the first one. I was the one who recovered the gospel." And it leads to basically an ousting from Wittenberg of Andreas Karlstadt and others who disagree with Luther on some fundamental concerns.
If you're just joining us on Progressive Spirit, I'm speaking with Brad Gregory. He's the author of Rebel in the Ranks, Martin Luther, the Reformation, and the Conflicts That Continue to Shape Our World. It's come out this year in softcover. It was released in 2017. So Martin Luther, had he not been shielded by his prince, and this is what I also got from your book, the Reformation might not have happened. Can you explain the importance of, well, I guess what we'd call today, secular authorities, although they wouldn't be called that then, in protecting him?
That's, yeah, absolutely right. They were secular in the sense of non-ecclesiastical, but certainly not secular in the sense of non-religious. They were devout Christians themselves in many instances, and that certainly was the case for Luther's protector, Frederick of Saxony. Now, Frederick of Saxony himself is an interesting figure because it's not at all clear, and probably the case, that he never himself adopted Luther's own views. He continued to protect him as, in a sense, his star theologian, and he certainly didn't want incursions on what he regarded as his university, which was located also in the city of Wittenberg. But almost certainly, if he had not defied the imperial order to turn Luther over, Luther probably would have gone the way of an early 15th century Bohemian reformer, Jan Hus, or John Huss, as he's known in English, who was delivered over to the Council of Constance and executed as a heretic. That well could have happened to Luther if the politics of his protection had gone differently.
It's hard to imagine these things. This is probably the real problem of history. Is it about the individual, or is it a wave of a movement? Would somebody else have taken that mantle on?
Well, it would be misleading to regard Luther as somehow coming out of the blue in terms of reforming initiatives within Latin Christendom, within the Catholic Church in the later 15th and early 16th centuries. There is significant reform, for example, underway already prior to him through, for example, the humanist reformer Erasmus of Rotterdam. It's a different vision of reform. It's a reform that very much sees and emphasizes the importance of learning and education, a slower kind of reform from within. So one could say that there's already reforming initiative going on within the church at the time. Luther takes it, though, and has a kind of catalyzing influence that certainly nobody foresaw. There's no way in 1516 anybody could have imagined that this ultra-devout Augustinian friar, or anyone else for that matter, is going to insist on a new theology of grace, a new soteriology, a way of understanding how God saves human beings that is going to become this extraordinary, galvanizing, unpredictable, and powerful movement that's going to run through the towns and cities of Central Europe within just two or three years and really turn things upside down by the middle of the 1520s. That just would not have been anticipated. So Luther certainly had a huge impact on the character of the reform that was going on, but it, you know, remains an open question as to what might have happened in the 16th century had Luther not come along and say the kind of more patient reforming vision based on education, based on an emphasis on classical virtues in relationship to Christianity, such as Erasmus and his supporters and colleagues had already been embarked on in the years just prior to Luther's emergence as a public figure.
Would you paint for us a picture of what life would be like in 1517, not only just in terms of daily life, but also how religion itself related to that and the larger culture?
It's a great question. It's a very important question because I think one of the most difficult things for those of us living in the early 21st century, particularly in the Western world, we are surrounded by a built environment that is so much the product of an industrial society since the 19th century of all kinds of technology, communication, travel, and so forth that makes our world radically different from the world of Western Europe in the early 16th century. a world with obviously no electricity, with no forms of rapid communication or transportation at all, a world of material scarcity. Even the wealthiest people at the time, I mean, aside from having some gold and jewels and extraordinary garments, live lives far, far more impoverished and far sort of closer to the natural rhythms of life, much more subject to the vagaries and disease and so forth than you know, even lower middle class people do today. That's just in terms of kind of the material uncertainty of life. As far as the pervasiveness of religion, though, of Christianity, that too is something that is almost unimaginable today, certainly in the United States. Religion is not separate from other domains of life, and it's not intended to be. The point is not to keep religion separate from politics, but to have Christianity inform politics. It's not to make economic exchange separate from religion, but to use critiques of avarice to try to restrain the human propensity for greed and so forth. So too with education, with gender relationships, with morality, with the wider culture. The point is, nothing is outside of God's creation, and nothing ought to be separate from Christianity's influence. That is an assumption not only characteristic of the late Middle Ages, but also one taken over by the Protestant reformers in their respective ways in the 16th century. And so that's part of the reason why the Reformation is such a wide-ranging, disruptive, and critically important long-term influence on what comes after it, because religion is always more than religion, we could say, in the late Middle Ages and into the 16th century.
Yeah, you're right that the Reformation isn't just a Protestant thing or a religious thing. That's right.
Not just religious in the way that we normally think about religion, right? And that's part of my analysis in the book as well, is about how did we in the modern Western world come to the view of religion that virtually everyone is inculcated with in the United States today, for example, right? Religion is it's a matter of individual preference about your own beliefs, your interior beliefs, about your preferred forms of worship in whatever religious community or church you want to belong to, and of your own individually chosen devotional practices, Bible study. If you're a Catholic, you might say the rosary, whatever the case may be. But religion certainly isn't about the public exercise of political power or about the regulation of economic exchange, right? Those are separate from religion. That difference is at the heart of what was wrought by the conflicts of the Reformation era.
That was ultimately, you argue, the consequence of the Reformation, but completely unintended.
Absolutely. Definitely unintended. Luther, Calvin, Martin Bucer, the other major reformers of the 16th century would have been horrified to see, I think, the long-term outcomes of what their actions led to. They wanted a more Christian society, not one in which religion is separated from all these other areas of life.
Brad Gregory, my guest. Rebel in the Ranks is his book, Martin Luther, the Reformation and the Conflicts That Continue to Shape Our World. You date the Reformation era from 1520 to 1650. What's the significance of 1650 and this Reformation era itself?
Right. So these are rough dates. 1520 in the sense of, to be honest, 1520 and 1650, because they're dates that end in zero, right? They're sort of easy decades to refer to, more or less. 1520 is a good date, I think, because that really is the year when, from Luther's own writings, he's calling the Pope the Antichrist by 1520. He writes a series of very important and influential treatises that are published in 1520. And it's really 1520 that we see, it's basically the point of no return as far as Luther's relationship with the papacy is concerned. So that's really when the early Reformation, we could say, as opposed to the very earliest beginnings of simply Luther becoming a public figure, are dated from. 1650, on the other end, is meant to be a rough date. If I was going to give a specific date for the European continent, I might say 1648, which is the end of the 30 Years' War, the last and the most destructive of what are oftentimes called the wars of religion. I, in my book, and in keeping with what I was just saying before about the pervasive influence of Christianity in all areas of life, I use the term the wars of more than religion, because religion was more than religion, to speak paradoxically. So 1648, the Peace of Westphalia, the end of the 30 Years' War. One could also push it in the British Isles, in England, back to 1660 if you wanted to, because in those couple of decades, the 1640s and 50s are the decades of the English Revolution, of the civil wars in which religion and politics are absolutely central, in which we see a reemergence of forms of radical Protestantism, with the breakdown of censorship and political control in a way that had not been seen anywhere in Europe since the early German Reformation. So in a way, it's the efflorescence of many different forms of Protestantism in the early 1520s, and then again in England in the 1640s and 50s, is another way of thinking about the Reformation era. After 1650, after 1660, thereabouts, that kind of widespread religio-political disruption in Europe is not something that we see in the same ways.
Well, let's talk about the religious wars. It's kind of a basic kind of question, or more than religious wars, as you mentioned. What are they fighting over?
Well, not all the wars, of course, are they're not all of a piece. They're not all the same kind of thing. I mean, I would, for example, include in the wars of more than religion the German Peasants' War of 1525, 1526, and that conflict is it's really about whether the gospel and the phrases like the freedom of a Christian, whether they entail any sort of fundamental social, political, and economic changes. In other words, does it mean, as many of those influenced by the early Reformation ideas think, does it mean getting rid of feudal, hierarchical, socioeconomic relationships? Does it mean an undoing of traditional relationships between political lords and serfs? There are hundreds of thousands of people in Central Europe that think that it does, and they rise in a series of uncoordinated rebellions starting in 1524 and lasting into 1526. That I would count that as the first of the wars of more than religion, because they are animated by, inspired by, a message of the gospel as they understand it. They're just as concerned with God's word and understanding it correctly, but in ways very, very different from, say, Luther, who thinks that the gospel is about, right, the interiority and the salvation of the individual. It should have nothing to do with altering the structures of society. So that's one early expression about one example of what they're fighting about, what the wars of more than religion are about. If we look at, for example, the Schmalkaldic War, another in the Holy Roman Empire in 1546 and 47, that really is a conflict between Catholic forces, really the impetus for which coming from the Holy Roman Empire, Charles V, against a league of Protestant cities and territories that are trying to defend the early institutionalization and the early promotion of the Reformation, either in a Lutheran or in some respects also in a Reformed Protestant expression. The French Wars of Religion in the second half of the 16th century, that is a kind of religio-political conflict between Calvinism, which has been influenced by John Calvin in Geneva, spreading into different towns and territories, different towns in France, especially in the southern part of France, and an intransigent and aggressive attempt by Catholics in France to suppress it. So there are the basic underlying point is that when religion, for example, as I said before, right, is implicated in all of these different areas of life, there's no way to change Christianity and what it means for education, for marriage, for property law, for politics, economics, and so forth. There's no way to have it not affect all those things. So that's why it's misleading to think that these people were just fighting over arcane points of doctrine or whatnot, because changes in religion affect all the things that religion is embedded in, and it's embedded in all of those other things. So in a sense, they're fighting over how human beings ought to live with one another in the hopes of eternal salvation, which is, of course, the other thing that makes the conflicts so intense. I mean, it would be one thing if this was just a political policy, you know, that might be changed. But we're talking about, right, God's revelation to human beings and the prospects for eternal salvation or damnation, which infuses the conflicts with so much urgency.
And finally, they're exhausted, right, by these wars. And it's really kind of the Dutch that come up with a solution that ends up being similar to the sort of solution that we might have today of privatizing or secularization. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. By the early 17th century, the Dutch Republic, which itself is born out of one of these conflicts, the conflict between Spain and the self-declared new nation, the United Provinces of the Netherlands or the Dutch Republic. And they see what's going on elsewhere. They see the wars of more than religion in France. They see the kinds of conflicts that are characteristic of many of the territories in Germany. And they choose a different way. They, in a certain sense, choose to de-emphasize religious uniformity and instead encourage people to go shopping, not to put it too bluntly, but they encourage commerce. And what they find in the course of what's sometimes referred to as the golden age of the Dutch Republic, this is the Dutch Republic of Vermeer and Rembrandt and all those extraordinary landscapes and portraits that people admire still today, what they discover is that the appeal of more and better material possessions tends to be something that large numbers of people, particularly those exhausted by and not keen on the prospect of more religiously inflected conflicts, they tend to be the sort of thing that lots of people want to pursue. And so part of the argument of my book is that it actually is the shared appeal of consumption that helps to lead the Dutch Republic first and then other areas in northwestern Europe, and eventually it's going to be the whole Western world, away from an emphasis on religion and toward an almost universally shared desire for more and better stuff.
That's so believe what you want, but buy stuff.
Yeah, essentially.
That's the Christmas message.
Once you see that and you start to think about it and I try to do this a bit in my book, once you see the way in which that basic impulse, that basic encouragement and those patterns of behavior are not simply something that happened idiosyncratically to emerge in the 17th century Dutch Republic, but become stronger, become more reinforced, and get a huge impetus, for example, starting in the late 18th century with the Industrial Revolution. What the Industrial Revolution does is allow many more people to buy many more things much more cheaply because of the forms of production, the way in which they're produced. Add to that the late 19th century, research universities in combination with nation states encouraging discoveries that can be taken from the natural sciences, what we today would call the STEM disciplines, applied in technology, in manufacturing techniques to make the stuff that consumers want. I mean, this is a long-term trajectory that is absolutely connected up with, one of the most pervasive combinations of ideological commitment and behavior that we see not only in the Western world, of course, but extend this now to globalization. So the Dutch hit on something that turns out, it wasn't fated to happen, but this is in fact how it has played out, that becomes a pervasive characteristic feature of the modern Western world, and by extension then, the rest of the world as well.
This is Progressive Spirit, progressivespirit.net. I'm speaking with Brad Gregory, author of Rebel in the Ranks, Martin Luther, the Reformation, and the conflicts that continue to shape our world. More to come. Stay with us. You're listening to the podcast version of Progressive Spirit. If you enjoy the show, please go to iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, Podomatic, TuneIn, or whatever podcast app you use to listen, and give Progressive Spirit 5 stars, won't you? Contact me through progressivespirit.net with your thoughts and ideas about the show, and be sure to share this podcast on your social media. Follow on Facebook and Twitter. The website, again, is progressivespirit.net. You're listening to Progressive Spirit, progressivespirit.net. I'm speaking with Professor of European History at Notre Dame, Brad Gregory, about how the Reformation ultimately caused the modern West to move religion to the private sphere and lift up shopping. Depending on how you look back at the story, certainly I have many friends and colleagues. I guess I thought this myself, that we've evolved from the superstition of religion and have become more enlightened with freedom of thought and freedom of religion and freedom to believe what you need to believe and not have to rely on any authority telling you what's true and whatnot is a good thing, and it's an evolution away from primitive kinds of thinking. But as I read your book, and I'm thinking about it more, I'm thinking, what did we really get free from? Did we not ultimately just get free from a collective, say, critique of unequal mass consumption?
Well, one of the things that I want to get across in the book is not only the mistake in thinking that Martin Luther proclaimed the freedom of a Christian and that somehow has a direct connection to or is expressed in the early 21st century in what is protected by laws in Western liberal democracies today as freedom, you know, freedom to do what one wants. Luther would be absolutely horrified by that. Another thing that I want to get across is what you're suggesting, which is, I mean, it is, you're right. I mean, especially in the United States, I think, and this is true also in Western European countries, there is a kind of deep and repeated inculcation of the notion that freedom itself it is one of the highest values and is a sort of unalloyed good. And one of the things I argue in the book is, and I think people can understand this if they reflect on it, I think it depends a lot on how people exercise their freedom. You know, this is not to put too specific and recent a point on the matter, but since 2016, for example, in both the United Kingdom and the United States, I think a lot of people exercise their freedom in ways that other people think were really horrific, terrible exercises of their freedom. And if we see, for example, the kinds of racist or misogynistic or homophobic or any other sorts of types of ideologies and views that many people find morally repugnant, but are held by people exercising their freedom, then it seems to me that the idea that freedom per se is always a good thing, that strikes me as problematic. It's certainly better than oppression per se, but the ways in which people exercise their freedom have profound influences. And if we think about the collective exercise of freedom by consumeristic and global Westerners, you know, whether we're talking the United States and Europe, or the ways in which globalization has extended those practices of consumption around the world, it's really not too far a stretch to talk about the ways in which the global environmental problems that we're facing now. Climate change is an indirect, unintended outcome of billions of people exercising their freedom to consume up to the level of their credit limit.
As I read your book, I was also thinking about the book Ishmael by Daniel Quinn. According mm-hmm. to Quinn, you know, there are laws of nature that exist independently of what we think about them. There are laws that govern the survival of the species. When we continue to flaunt them, eventually we'll go extinct. The planet has its limits. Humans are really ultimately not gods over above nature. So that was my question back to the reformers. Luther and Calvin, they thought that humans were over and above nature too, didn't they? I mean, is our problem of unintended consequences of the Reformation or does it even go back further to perhaps civilization itself?
Yeah, I mean, that's a, you know, the kind of questions that I raise in my book lend themselves to even bigger questions yeah. like that. You know, I'm a bit more hesitant to, you know, try to say anything substantive on a matter like that. I certainly think that and I make this clear in the book as well. It's not as if the world prior to the Reformation didn't have grave problems of its own. It did. It certainly did. And not only with respect to Christianity or the character of the Roman Church, Latin Christendom, but they weren't the same kinds of problems as are characteristic of either, say, the Reformation era or what we see in the kind of world that we're facing today, that is in such complicated and unintended ways, the long-term outcome of attempts to deal with the problems of the 16th and 17th centuries. So, I mean, if one were going to write a kind of analysis about, you know, the sorts of the what are the central problems and challenges of different civilizations in different eras, I think one could very well extend that further back in time than I've done in my book. But what's, I think, so important about the Reformation era is because it occurs where it does in Western Europe. And of course, there was nothing fated about this. There was nothing, set in stone about the influence that European civilization and nation states were going to have in the future when we look at the 16th century. But it has turned out that there's no way to understand the contemporary world, the planet Earth and human civilizations on it, apart from the incredible influence of Europe on it. Nation states, the emergence of modern science and technology, the military capacities and their exercise, all of these things are rooted in and come out of Western Europe. In the 19th and 20th centuries, of course, they are extended through imperial colonialisms of various sorts, and we're dealing with the consequences of all that. So that's why this particular set of problems in Europe during the Reformation era, whether we like it or not, in order to understand the problems and the conflicts that continue to shape our world, you've got to understand this, because the attempts institutionally and ideologically to deal with those problems are the same institutions, the same kinds of solutions that we're seeing in later forms today.
Brad Gregory is my guest on Progressive Spirit. He's the author of Rebel in the Ranks, Martin Luther, the Reformation, and the conflicts that continue to shape our world. Is there a sense in which the issue comes down to ultimately to authority, any kind of authority or any kind of common language, any kind of common jurisprudence? I don't know, something that we can refer to. Luther broke it open by when he said the Pope isn't it, or the councils aren't it, it's the Bible. And then it just kind of opened everything up because people disagreed about that. And even one might even say that historical criticism of the Bible is an eventual result, perhaps, of the Reformation, perhaps unintended. But Is that kind of our problem of finding that the Reformation broke open the idea of authority itself?
I think that's right, in the sense of what is asserted as the solution to the problem of problems within the church, the kinds of longstanding concerns about the gap between what Christian teaching is on the one hand and the way members of the clergy and laity for the most part are actually living on the other, that the solution to that problem is supposed to be the unshakable cornerstone of God's word. But in indisputable ways, and this really is just a matter of understanding the overwhelming evidence, that proves to be the cornerstone is the stumbling block, and that is a huge problem. And the conflicts of the Reformation era lead, in intellectual terms, to a turn toward, well, reason alone is going to be the modern savior. This is the Enlightenment credo in one way or another. It's the kind of animating desire of modern philosophy from Descartes in the 17th century up at least into the 20th century. And it turns out that the emphasis on reason alone doesn't work either. I mean, that's really what the core of postmodernism in the late 20th and early 21st century is about. So, yeah, I mean, I do think that questions of authority are absolutely at the center of the kinds of not only the conflicts of the Reformation era, but I think also with respect to the challenges and the problems that we face in the early 21st century as well. And it's very, very difficult to try to envision a way of dealing with that particular problem in political cultures that are as adamant about the insistence on individual self-determination, autonomy, and rights as our political culture is.
Have thinking about the United States, and I don't know if it's unique in this, has it become, has the state in itself taken the place of religion? The idea of kind of the United States and with its military and with its consumerism kind of in it, and it's what, city on a hill, that it has become in itself its own god?
Well, I think that particular question, I think, has a differentiated answer. By that, I mean, I think for some people, whether they acknowledge it or not, their devotion to, commitment to the United States does function in that way. I mean, in the sense of a kind of, well, one could say, you know, at what point does patriotism, assuming there is a healthy form of that, sort of shade off into and eventually turn into a kind of idolatry of the nation state, in this case, the United States. Certainly there are, learned and insightful critics who have argued that the kind of, and I think that modern nationalism in general, in its 19th, 20th century forms, and that one can certainly still see in expressed probably more in the United States than in most Western European countries. And I think that's really the difference there is, you know, the European experience between the beginning of World War I in 1914 through the disruptions of the interwar period and then the horrors of World War II. They were disabused of their nationalist fantasies, at least for quite a while. What's going on right now in Europe in the last few years, I mean, again, we have to qualify that too. But in the United States, that didn't go through that. I think there's been a much more robust continuation of a kind of adulation of the nation state in ways that I think one can make a case that at least some people, the state functions in the way that their commitment to Christianity would have in generations past. At the same time, there are also strong critics of American militarism, of American presumption that its vision of what is good for the world ought to be accepted by the rest of the world and so forth.
In the Constitution of the United States, life, liberty, and the pursuit of, well, is it happiness or is it property? Are they the same thing? I mean, that creed came from, in a sense, a solution to religious wars, privatizing religion for the good of this happiness.
Right. I mean, that's, you know, the what's interesting about that particular iconic phrase, you know, from our founding documents is, of course, a right to life, but nothing in any of the documents about how actually to live, right? A right to liberty, but nothing about how to exercise your freedom, your liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, but nothing about what happiness actually is. That's deliberately, all those things are deliberately left up to individuals to determine for themselves. One of the reasons why the impetus behind the institutional separation of church and state, the division of powers and so forth that we find in the founding documents, the reason why it works so well in the U.S., relatively speaking, and let's bracket for the time being the enormous reality of chattel slavery, of course, in the United States up until the 1860s. But if we set that aside, the way in which Americans who have individually protected freedom of religion from the time of the founding, the way in which they exercise their freedom in those decades, let's say the first half of the 19th century, is close enough to other Americans with whom, right, they might they might not share a particular church affiliation. Somebody's a Baptist, someone else is a Methodist, so-and-so is a Presbyterian. But the way, the presumption is their moral views, their understanding of what they owe to their neighbors or what a family is and so forth are still so close to one another that the social effect of that allows religion to be, as Alexis de Tocqueville said in the early 1830s, he says religion is the most important of the Americans' political institutions. And that's what he was talking about. It functions as a kind of cohesive force in society when the content of the ways in which people are exercising their freedom, right, has a collectively cohesive effect. But take life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness and ask now, how do people actually live? How do they exercise their freedom? What do they think happiness is? It's no longer functioning in a cohesive way. It shows just how incredibly empty, if I could use that metaphor, our founding documents are about the substance of how people should live and what they should do with themselves, what they should care about, what values they should espouse, what they should aspire to. I think, just objectively speaking, sociologically, we see in the conflicts around us in the United States the lack of any kind of consensus around those sorts of issues, and I think that helps to account for the sorts of difficulties that we are dealing with today.
Well, I'm going to get theological on you and ask you this question. I mean, in some cases, what we live for is buying stuff. I mean, I think as a preacher, I mean, the biggest heresy I talk about is, you know, consumerism, I think, and challenging the notion that maybe we ought not to just buy anything we want, or that the economy is supposedly always supposed to grow. My question is what is freedom? In terms of, is there a sense in which Luther call it bondage of that? You know, certainly there were materialists and there was avarice and there was greed in Luther's time, and they talked about it and all that kind of thing. But today it almost has been lifted up as a virtue. And given to us by people in authority that unless you go buy stuff, you're not a good American.
Absolutely, that's the case. I mean, I'm sure you, not all listeners perhaps, are old enough to remember this, but you know, those of us of a certain age are. Within days of the 9/11 attacks in 2001, President Bush was there, right, exhorting, pleading with Americans, go out and buy things. The best thing you can do right now for our country is to go out and get this economy humming again. Mm-hmm. We hear the same kinds of things this time of year prior to Christmas, really. You know, what is the effect of, you know, buying Christmas presents going to be on the economy and so forth? What happens I teach a course at Notre Dame called Christianity, Commerce, and Consumerism, the last 1,000 years. So we start before the medieval commercial revolution of the 11th and 12th centuries and run all the way up through the Reformation era, the Enlightenment, modern industrialization, and so forth, and arrive finally at the kind of wide open consumer choice with respect to religion or non-religion. You can believe literally whatever you want within the law, and you can buy whatever you want, as much as you want, whatever you want, without regard for anyone else. These two things, this kind of open-ended emphasis on choice, is what characterizes contemporary American culture. What happened is in the 17th and the 18th centuries, we see a very explicit and deliberate transformation of the valence and the assessment of what had been regarded as the deadly sin of avarice in Christianity, and it flips. A better way maybe to think about this is, every time you see self-interest in the modern world, think of avarice. Basically, it's just called something less offensive. But the idea, the assumption that people naturally want more and better stuff, that there's nothing wrong with this, that in fact this is a benign and a wonderful way in which, right, the market serves human desires and so forth, this is it's absolutely pervasive. From a traditional Christian point of view, there is absolutely no doubt whatsoever that what is regarded today as perfectly normal, natural, people going, acquiring more things, discarding things, getting more things and so forth, for more than 1500 years in Christianity, was regarded as a deadly sin and destructive not only of individual souls, but also of the common good and of individuals' relationship with God. Because as Paul says, right, he calls avarice an idol. And I think that from my own sensibilities as well, Christians who are serious about their faith of whatever background or church would do well to reflect on that and think about the ways that it's related to their own practices in life.
My guest on Progressive Spirit has been Brad Gregory, Rebel in the Ranks, Martin Luther, the Reformation, and the conflicts that continue to shape our world. In about 60 seconds, can you say what you'd like people to do with this information? What do you hope society will do? If I can put that to you. I've always hated those questions. I know, because they aren't.
Yeah, no, I mean, and especially historians, right? We interpret the past and try to understand how it's related to the present, but we're usually not very good at either exhorting or prophesying. I mean, my limited hope with my book and the analysis in it would be simply to make more people more self-reflective about the world that we live in, how it got to be the way that it is, and to perhaps question some of their own unquestioned assumptions about what makes a human life valuable and why, and also to think about things like how, you know, individual behaviors of consumption, linked as they are to a global network of industrial production, factory conditions in developing countries in the world, and really open-ended consumption of ever more stuff is contributing to environmental problems, concerns about climate change, and so forth. These things are all connected to one another. And so maybe it's not too much or too grandiose to say that some people who reflect on what I analyze in my book might actually change their lives.
All right. Brad Gregory, thank you so much for your work, and thanks so much for being with me today.
This was a real pleasure. Thanks very much for having me on your show.
Progressive Spirit is heard every week. On Progressive Spirit, you hear interviews with cutting-edge scholars, authors, and activists who have something to say about social justice, human flourishing, and things that matter. Progressive Spirit is formatted for radio and is distributed every week through the Pacifica Radio Network, the Public Radio Exchange, and Global Community Radio. Progressive Spirit is on the broadcast schedule of about 20 stations around the country. Ask your favorite station to add Progressive Spirit to its weekly lineup. You can download Progressive Spirit for free on iTunes, Google Play, Podomatic, Stitcher, Spotify, TuneIn, or your favorite podcast app. The website is progressivespirit.net. Follow also on Facebook and Twitter. Progressive Spirit is produced in the studios of KBOO in Portland, Oregon. I'm John Schuck. Be well.